could do a better job of talking about and communicating masculinity in a more healthy way. And I think I put in the conclusion, like, this is something that the Christian tradition has plenty of resources for.
Welcome to Dangerous Dogma, the authority on questioning authority. I'm Brian Kaler, president of Word and Way. You can learn more about us at wordandway.org. In this episode, we're going to have a conversation with Lisa Weaver Schwartz. She's the author of the new book, Stained Glass Ceilings: How Evangelicals Do Gender and Practice Power. This is a really fascinating book, and I'm excited to have this conversation, as we'll be talking about a couple of different seminaries and the way that they do gender and practice power differently. Lisa brings her expertise as a sociologist to help us see and understand what's happening in ways that perhaps we wouldn't notice on our own. I highly recommend this book, and I think that you'll want to pick it up after listening to this conversation. But before we jump into that, I want to remind you that if you haven't done so yet, you really need to subscribe to Word and Way's award-winning email newsletter, A Public Witness. There we explore a number of topics at the intersection of faith, culture, and politics. Learn more and subscribe today at publicwitness.wordandway.org. And now here's my conversation with Lisa Weaver Schwartz on Stained Glass Ceilings. Well, Lisa, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Yeah, I'm really excited to talk about your new book, Stained Glass Ceilings: How Evangelicals Do Gender and Practice Power. It's a fascinating book. I really enjoyed it. But let's set the stage. I want to walk through our couple of seminaries here that you're going to be talking about. But first, I want to set the stage with you. So a little bit of, you know, people help people understand who you are and the approach you're taking as a sociologist. And tell us a little bit about the research approach that you were taking for this book.
Yeah, well, so I, as a sociologist grad student, was really interested, as I still am, in this kind of intersection of religion and culture and gender. Sort of came along later as this project emerged. But I started noticing that there was a lot of conversation in the sociological world about gendered family life, which is important. And then there were a couple of pieces that looked at how religious groups, how especially American Christian groups and denominations, their policies on women in ordained kind of ministries and authoritative positions. But what there wasn't a lot of was sort of a look at what we would call lived religion, or sort of just the lived realities of what's happening, the practice, which is what, of course, culture is all about, practice, right? And so that was kind of my introduction into this project. So I do look at it very much as it's purely a qualitative work. I know so some sociology is very much sort of numbers-based statistical analysis. This is more of an interpretive cultural approach to some of these questions that have been versions of them have been fleshed out in more sort of quantitative and of course again in the question of family ways. So that's kind of how I came to this as a sociologist. I'm also a person of faith, so that you know, of course, we tend to study things that are pertinent to our own experiences. And I come from a different tradition. I'm not a pure insider in either of these spaces, but I think that background and having lived in and experienced as a woman in religious spaces and in conservative Protestant spaces, both egalitarian and complementarian, I think I sort of already knew that things were more complicated than just this dichotomy between complementarian and egalitarian. So there's a personal element and also a sociological kind of story behind the book.
Yeah. And so, you know, we're going to be primarily talking then about the two seminaries that you studied, Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and Asbury Theological Seminary, which are geographically proximate, but obviously in a lot of theological issues, and particularly thinking about gender, as you write about, are very different. But you mentioned this idea of doing qualitative research. And so, why don't we talk a little bit more about what you're actually doing? Because, I mean, you went to the schools, you're interviewing people. I want to talk a little bit about that process, because, again, it's not the quantitative, data-driven. You're showing up and having conversations as well as just observing what's happening on campus.
Yeah. So when I started the project, I thought it was going to be primarily an interview project. And that's how I started doing a sets of semi-structured interviews, mostly with students and also some faculty members and administrators. So there's a lot of so the method there would be content analysis, right? So the words, the language that the people were using to describe their experiences, their beliefs. But as I was and I did spend a lot of time on both of these campuses, partly just, you know, to waiting on interviews. And I just started noticing that there's way more going on than just, of course, the discourse that is happening. So at Southern specifically, I would go take day trips there during the field research stage, and the campus was just so rich with meaning and symbolism. And of course, it's again a part of cultural sociology to notice those things. And so I also experienced a lot of their worship services in their chapels. I was able to sit in on a few classrooms, a few kind of after hours events and sort of groups that were meeting. And in all of those, I maintained, I think, throughout the project, an interest in the discourse, the rhetoric. I think I'm just always drawn to, you know, people use words in very different ways, and they have very different kind of subjective meanings depending on who they're talking to and what the context is. So I continued to just be really fascinated by the language that these students especially were using to describe their beliefs. But then also I really very quickly got sidetracked with the material and visual culture, the architecture, the artwork that was all over these campuses, especially at Southern. There's narrative built into the fabric of the community in embodied ways. So the even things that like the things that they eat, the menus that are available, the kind of clothing that they're wearing is all just kind of just really rich with the meaning. So so the project really morphed from just the interview stage to a much more I think rich, and I thought it was much more interesting when I could start looking at these other kind of images and parts of the culture as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things you do really well in the book is you take us on campus with you, you know, and you take us inside events. And, you know, we're not just hearing what people are saying, we're experiencing and reading about some of the what's happening, side conversations or the way people are dressed, the way people are reacting, which helps us get a feel for it. So let's talk about the seminaries then. And we'll start with Southern Seminary, because that's where you start in the book. For those that aren't familiar with the school, we should probably do a little bit of a quick kind of background of who is the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, and then, you know, particularly today.
Hmm. Yeah, so Southern Baptist Theological Seminary is in Louisville, Kentucky, and it is the flagship seminary for the Southern Baptist Convention. The current president, who's been there for over 25 years now, is Al Mohler, who's a name that is, I think, fairly familiar in the kind of intersection of religion and politics in the American context. So he's a big name. There's a lot of Southern Baptist theology and discourse that comes out of the seminary. I think the flagship word is a good way to describe it. And it also mirrors the history of the Southern Baptist Convention, which a lot of people don't realize that it has gone through a lot of different phases and stages in its life. What the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary looks like in Louisville now is not at all what it looked like 25, 35 years ago. And so it has this really difficult past. It used to be a much more open to different theological perspectives. There were Arminians, pacifists, feminists who are on faculty, which you would never find there now. It's very, very conservative and very kind of fairly narrow in its theological and cultural commitments now. So the book tells a bit of a story of that history. It's a story that the seminary tells and wants its students to know, and it builds an identity around this tumultuous past the story kind of mirrors the biblical narrative of creation in sort of a pure orderly world of conservatism, then infiltrated, you know, paralleling the Genesis fall, infiltrated by the liberals. And then, of course, salvation at the hands of Al Mohler as he entered the scene in 1993.
Yeah.
I have to laugh because, you know, Mueller and I have had our moments in the past. So I don't know if you... He last year called me a liberal nitwit. So that's, you know, fun times. So.
He is a colorful character. And he, I tell you, he has been interesting to watch even as I have, you know, the process of this book coming together and editing it has you know, paralleled some cultural and political movement of his own, even in the last 8 or 9 years. So, yeah, he's always, you know, always has something interesting to say.
So obviously at Southern Seminary, as you write about, there's this really stark line, male and female. There's very specific spaces, who can be in what space, in what role. Can we talk a little bit about, you know, what you're seeing at Southern Seminary? I think for a lot of people, perhaps that grew up in a conservative evangelical church, a lot of this would be somewhat familiar, but these lines are really rigid at Southern Seminary, perhaps even more so than the way they might be experienced as it kind of trickles down into a congregational life.
Yeah, so one of the things that I found, even in the very early interview stages, just in the discourse and the rhetoric, order is very important in this community. And there's sort of this sense that God has an order in mind for human social life. And that order includes not only kind of male headship, the men over women, it's kind of a hierarchical organization, but just this what I call polarization, right? So men and women are very, very different kinds of people. And so they have created and constructed a community that that lives this out in an embodied way, just as you said. So there's now one thing that sometimes surprises people is that women are allowed and even encouraged to enter their MDiv programs. And I think all of the academic programs are open to women. But very, very few women enter them and actually go through that process. So it, you know, sort of like functional polarization, if not in the actual rules. There are a few spaces though that are limited. So preaching classes, that's sort of coded as a place where, you know, male headship is really important, and so women who are in the MDiv programs are kind of rerouted to a women's ministry class or something that puts them more in, you know, women's only spaces. So by virtue of all of that sort of both formal and informal rules, the spaces of education and the classroom spaces really are male dominated. And of course, because of their hierarchical kind of headship belief, the only people who are teaching those theological and biblical classes are men. On the other side, though, and this is what kind of surprised me, there's this really thriving subculture of women that have. I kind of set a scene by describing the Seminary Wives Institute, which is it's an educational space in itself, but it's educating the wives of male seminarians on what their roles will be and what the expectations will be on them as Southern Baptist pastors' wives. And this is a very particular script that they are preparing to enter. It can be very overwhelming. And so they talk about everything from discipleship to child rearing to there's a class you can take to learn how to play the piano, because that's, of course, still an important part of Southern Baptist, some congregations. And then they do learn some Southern Baptist history, but there's a lot. What I found in those spaces is that it's much less about the content than it is about the interactions with the teachers, who are the wives of the seminary professors. So Al Mohler's wife Mary is in charge of this, and the other faculty wives are also there with her, teaching about things like throwing baby showers and how to disciple your children and how to maybe lead women's ministry. So it's very, again, very polarized, not only in how they think and how they talk, but also in these spaces that they've created. And again, the rhetoric is very different in the spaces. And their argument is that this is how humans are created to live in this very orderly, organized way. And that this is, of course, how human flourishing is best accomplished.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I really appreciate. And you acknowledge this in the book, that your role, your status as a woman, on the one hand, was limiting in some spaces as you were trying to have conversations with people, but then it also opened up opportunities and doors for you to be able to hear some of these conversations and perhaps have, you know, people open up to you in ways that they might not have spoken to or allowed a male researcher to come in. And so you really do help us to see inside some of these communities, sub-communities on campus that, you know, aren't the ones that get all the attention. because again, you know, it's not Moeller, it's not the professors, and that's, you know, generally what the attention is on the campus of Southern Seminary. And one of the other things that you reference, and one of the things you talk about, some of the changes at Southern Seminary is, you know, it's not just the preaching courses, which obviously I think a lot of people would be like, okay, so obviously in Southern Baptist theology today, women aren't allowed to preach. So we're not going to let them take the preaching course. We're not going to let them, you know, preach in that class. But even other places on campus can become contentious, such as the former now Carver School of Church Social Work. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that situation, because it's an older story that today isn't as well known, but I think it's a really helpful in understanding some of the dynamics of gender at Southern Seminary.
Yeah, this was a story that I wasn't very much aware of before I started the project, and it really stood out to me. So before Moeller came in, and this was in the sort of previous version of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, right? They had this really thriving school of social work that was led by Diana Garland. And I think it's really interesting that social work I guess I should tell the rest of the story. So with Moeller's introduction, there's just a lot of controversy around, who was going to be able to be employed by Southern. Are you a complementarian? There's just this vetting out and a little bit of a cleaning of house when Moeller came in of the faculty. And one of the big controversies was about a candidate named David Sherwood, who was conservative in his credentials, looked like a great, great fit for the School of Social Work. That is, I mean, social work is a field that really kind of gives embodied practice to Christian ethics, right? And so this is what what the school had built up under Diana Garland. And so she came to Moeller with this candidate, David Sherwood. And long story short, he ended up rejecting him because he couldn't articulate a complementarian male headship belief. And later on, I mean, it took a while. There's a whole story that goes into, you know, this transition into the kind of Moeller's regime later. But Moeller ended up cutting the program. The Carver School was removed from Southern Baptist Seminary, which I think is really important in a number of ways. But the one I think you're referencing here is that this social work as a discipline, it has accreditation requirements, and it is under the authority of the other authorities, right? So it's not just a churchly institution, and so that means that when Moeller cut the program, I mean it created this space, this institutional space, where the only programs left, the theology, missions, Bible, all of these things, remain purely under religious control and under Southern Baptist control, right? There is no other outside institution. And it also really created much more of a heady intellectual space and removed the practice of ethics from the educational institution. Now, they did replace the social work degree with the biblical counseling degree, and that is the one that most of the women, well, I don't know if I should say most, but the majority of the women that I talked to anyway, and I think that's still a high population of Southern students who are women, find themselves in this biblical counseling degree, which sounds similar to social work, but it's not, because there's no credentialing, which means that the only jobs that are available are going to be within the church, hence under the male headship, right? And so it really, really, it removed the possibility that a woman could come get a degree at Southern Seminary, go out, have a career on her own, and serve the church in that way, in a way that was not under the authority of, or only under the authority of people like Moeller.
Yeah, so you mentioned complementarianism, and of course the other idea of egalitarianism that we'll get to with Asbury. And so we should probably pause here just to make sure people, these are generally familiar terms, but just to make sure we understand, because this is a really significant difference between the two seminaries that you studied.
Yeah, and I think, to be honest, I don't love these two terms, because I think even in my own experience, they just don't do justice to what is actually happening, which is kind of like the personal reason behind writing this book, I guess. But generally, when we say complementarian, what I've just described fits really, really well. The Southern Baptist orientation question around the differences. Men and women are very, very different, and male headship. Those would be the two, certainly the defining characteristics at Southern, and I think in general, in complementarian spaces too, that men should be heads of women by God's design, certainly in church leadership and probably also in homes and families. So that's complementarianism, kind of in a nutshell. But egalitarianism is another framework that eliminates the hierarchy and suggests that men and women are created equal by God, the Imago Dei, created in God's image, without hierarchy. And this is what Asbury, the second institution that I looked at, kind of promoted. And it gets a little bit tricky because I think a lot of people assume that egalitarianism sort of defies hierarchy altogether. But what I found is that there's still a lot of kind of latent hierarchy in the assumptions of how marriage relationships should work. And so it varies, right? Some people might call themselves egalitarian, but still think that male headship is important in marriage. So that's one of those places where it's a little bit slippery. But in broad strokes, complementarians believe in male headship. Egalitarians think that, you know, the equality principle would trump that.
And then, of course, one thing is I want to highlight at Southern before we move on is that it's not just, you know, this isn't just a story for this seminary or even just this denomination. That Southern Seminary, the Southern Baptist Convention, as the largest Protestant denomination, has a lot of impact on evangelical world and Protestant conservative Christianity in general. And I think one example of this is the opening story that you have that I love as you start the book with a gathering of the Council on Biblical Manhood and Womanhood. Which the story itself, I mean, I think if people go to like Amazon or some of the places, they can generally read like the first few pages. So they can start the book, read the first story, it's great, and then, you know, buy the whole book. But I wonder if you can introduce to this organization, because I think it's a good example of why this story matters beyond just Southern Seminary.
Yes. So CBMW is probably the most well-known organization that's really promoting this version of now very reformed complementarianism. And just a bit of background on them. They emerged in the 80s really as a response to what they were concerned about feminism, basically, right? And so kind of codified their beliefs in very much framing it in terms of the Genesis creation narrative, and they exist to promote complementarianism. Now, it is a different organization than Southern, right? So it might seem a little bit odd that I led into the book about these seminaries with this other organization, but the ties are very, very thick. Not only Al Mohler has been very much, very much involved in CBMW throughout its history. The conference that I attended, Owen Strand was the president of CBMW and also a faculty member at Southern in their undergraduate wing at the time. And there were several other really key figures that kind of spanned the gap between the two. And so the history, even historically and in contemporary practice, there are just a lot of ties between the two. But CBMW is also probably well known even outside of people who are in the Southern Baptist Convention. It's kind of become, it seems, the go-to place for resources on complementarianism, gender and sexuality. They're very much tied into the Gospel Coalition. And so I thought it was really important to start with that because it is something that has really so deeply influenced evangelicalism and I think even maybe American Protestantism more broadly. It's a very influential group and their voices ring very loudly.
So let's hop in the car and we're gonna drive to the other campus. Where are we heading and who is this school?
Yes. So I love the imagery because that drive, I know that drive very well. It's through this lovely bluegrass region of Kentucky where I now live, actually. And so as we're passing all of these horse farms and beautiful stone fences, eventually from Louisville, you will emerge in the small town of Wilmore, Kentucky, where Asbury Theological Seminary sits. And Asbury is in some ways very similar to Southern, very self-consciously evangelical, also in the interest of training pastors, missionaries, sort of Christian educators for a slightly different tradition. They come out of the Wesleyan holiness tradition and kind of maintain not denominational ties, but still serve a number of denominations that are sort of evangelical, Wesleyan, Methodist, Nazarenes, and a whole number of other denominations. And they would represent the more egalitarian framework that I described earlier. So they are very intentional, not only about not talking about male headship in churchly leadership specifically, but they have tried very hard to create and construct a community that is empowering to women, that will allow women to exercise authority and leadership in churchly spaces. So I think the introductory vignette that I used there was of this service that I attended. It was a communion service, which is communion is very important to this community, presided over by their dean of the chapel, who is a woman. And this is something that is just a really important ritual for the community. And it's very, very symbolic to them that they're kind of, she's kind of basically a campus pastor is a woman. And they've made really intentional decisions to hire women to teach classes in preaching and ethics and you know, sort of all across campus. Now, their numbers are still very low, which is one of the first things that I noticed. The women on faculty are very much still outnumbered by men, and women in their degree programs, especially the MDiv and ministerial degree programs, are also outnumbered by their male colleagues. So that was one of my first kind of cues that maybe there's more going on here than just the intention of creating a community that is not affected by gender hierarchy. So yeah, Asbury is a little bit more of a complicated picture, but its intention is to be a community that is empowering to men and women, where gender does not hold anyone back.
Yeah, but as you noted, there it's definitely an aspirational goal at some level. And so what are some of the factors? Why is this? Because Asbury is not unique in this, right? There's a number of seminaries, a number of denominations that advance, you know, the cause of women in ministry, will say that, yes, we support women in ministry. But then when you look at their numbers, there's, you know, a very small percentage of their congregations actually have ever had a female pastor. So, you know, there's obviously some factors here. So what's happening at Asbury, what you could find that explains this disparity?
Well, one of the most important things, I think, is to recognize that Asbury and Southern and any other religious community is not a sort of like holy bubble separated from the rest of society and the world, right? There's, you know, these are people who interact with American culture because these are both in the American context, both influenced by the history and historical legacies of you know, the society that we live in. And so there's all of these patterns that are going on around us and around them that very much influence not only institutional histories, for example, who has been in charge. So Asbury, one of the most striking images in the book is this picture I took in their boardroom where there's portraits of all of their presidents hanging around on the walls, and all eight of them are white American men. Right. And this isn't because Asbury has made that decision. Right. In fact, I'm sure that if we'd ask them, they would say, oh, we would love it if we would have a female president. That'd be great. But the reality is that they have emerged in this context that does center white American men. Right. And often white American men who are married, which sort of the centering of marriage is kind of key in both of these situation. So I think one of the things that I found at Asbury, though, is that they don't really have a framework to deal with this past, the cultural legacies, and even things like the second shift is a sociological term that we use to describe a lot of the extra domestic labor that women end up practicing, even in self-consciously egalitarian families. Women end up being the ones who, you know, write the Christmas cards and do the decorating, and which ends up to just more hours of labor. And so Asbury's framework, as much as they talk about gender and talk about wanting to be empowering to women, they do it in a particular way that I've referred to as gender blindness, which I have kind of mixed feelings about that term. But it kind of mirrors the colorblind approaches to racism that we also see in a lot of these spaces. But what it means is that they're being they tend not to want to talk about gender a lot. So what it means is that they've opened the doors of, you know, opportunity in some ways to women, but they've not really been able to grapple with some of these structural patterns, cultural legacies, because there's sort of this sense that like we've done what we needed to do. We've made it possible for women to enter leadership and ordained ministry. And so I think that way of talking, that discourse that really doesn't weave like lament for some of these past problems. And even it also sort of makes it difficult for women to come to a collective identity because there's a sense that, you know, if we talk too much about women's issues and being women, it might sound a little bit like Southern's like Seminary Wives Institute, and we don't want to go there. And it also might just kind of drive us in the wrong direction, right? If talking about gendered categories is the problem, you know, that's what kept women out of leadership in the first place for complementarians. Then the less we talk about it, then the better, right? And so what I found as a consequence of this is that a lot of the men, especially the male students, they didn't see a problem, right? They thought, I had this one that said, you know, I think Asbury's doing a great job. A student's a student, right? Man or woman. It's just everybody's treated the same. And but then on the flip side, there are a lot of the women students that I spoke with who were really struggling and really perplexed, even as they found the empowerment and they were really thriving in some ways. They questioned whether they fit in that context. There is one a story that I heard from a female faculty member. She said they had just gotten out of this chapel service where I think her words were, this big, powerful man preached a big, powerful sermon. And this very gifted young woman student came into her office just weeping and saying, I don't belong here. I shouldn't be in seminary. I could never do that. Right. And so there's without having the tools to understand that the standards that they're being held to, the patterns that are framing their experiences are centered around men. They don't have the ability to explain that to themselves, and they don't have the solidarity with each other to sort of flesh that out. There's a lot of struggle that goes on for the women.
We'll be right back with the rest of this conversation. But first, I want to remind you that you should subscribe to Warden Way's award-winning e-newsletter, A Public Witness. It will help you make sense of the world of faith, culture, and politics. Learn more and subscribe today at publicwitness.wardenway.org. And now, back to our conversation.
You know, as you're talking about some of these things that are happening, some of these tensions, as you said, this is a complicated, you know, picture and story that you're developing. You know, we've got this blindness and, you know, almost this sense of, well, it's okay for women to be pastors. We'll support them as long as they're not too female, as long as, you know, they kind of adopt to some of the, you know, male traditional styles and dress and so forth. I mean, that's something that you highlight is this, the norms are not necessarily completely divorce from kind of masculine norms.
Yeah, there's this real ambivalence about what to do with femininity, because the norm has been male and masculine, right? So you're used to seeing your pastor up front in a suit. You're used to him having a wife who will play the piano and teach kids Sunday school. That's normal. And so when women step into these spaces where they're working toward these roles, I think nobody quite knows what to do. And so there's a sense that, well, real women do have some sort of a feminine affect, right? So there's, you don't want to be, don't, androgyny is not something that this community is interested in. So too much of an androgynous appearance would, I think, be suspect. But at the same time, as other women really sort of struggled just to know, you know, how to put on their femininity, and they're not sure if they should wear lipstick when they preach. They feel like some of them that I interacted with, one that came from more of a deep South context and had more, like, she curled her hair and had more of a feminine affect. She really, really struggled. She was the one that told me a story about one of her classmates accused her of being a radical feminist, which is a very, very, very bad word at Asbury, because she had questioned whether or not, I think, Charles Wesley would have been taken seriously if he was a woman. So and her, you know, she was just trying to figure out, like, what if her her appearance and if her dress styles were setting her up too far apart from men and making her seem sort of other. Other women worried about being over-sexualized and men sort of not wanting to interact with them, faculty members being concerned about how they were mentoring them. Just because of their appearance. So this, like I said, it's very much like a tightrope that these women walk to, you know, establish that they're feminine enough to be legitimate women and to uphold, because Asri does still hold to a strong gender binary. So that's an important piece of the puzzle right now. So you know, to establish that on one hand, but then on the other hand, not to be seen as feminine, too overly feminine, to be looked at as kind of irrational and flighty and emotional. So it's a delicate balance. And again, it's complicated by the fact that they don't really have solidarity with each other and the ability to really flesh these things out in community.
Yeah. And then, of course, there's also a lot of other cultural factors. I mean, you just made a reference to Southern culture. I mean, both these schools that you're looking at are in Kentucky. And, you know, there's obviously, some of that cultural in thinking about gender roles, as well as, I mean, you can unpack these separately, because you acknowledge in the book that also this is very much a white story. And that's just because of the nature of the two schools, that you were basically only able to really explore this topic among, you know, white students and white faculty, because that's, other than some international students, that pretty much describes these two schools, which again also feels like a little bit of that Southern, you know, holdover culture.
Yeah, it is. So you're right. Both of these are in Kentucky, and that does frame the analysis and the experiences. I do think it's important to note, though, that they're drawing students from all over. So I don't know that I even talked with any students from Kentucky, probably a couple. But they're not regional schools, right? They're drawing from nationally and even internationally. However, the place does matter. And Kentucky is a very white place. And both of these schools are very, very white schools. And I think that's something that, you know, I got halfway through the project and started realizing how many parallels there are to even to how these students were talking about gender to what we know about how evangelicals, white evangelicals, talk about race. There's a lot of parallels with Michael Emerson's Divided by Faith. And so I got kind of halfway through and realized this and kind of had to make the decision, like, do I expand or do, you know, and try to tell a story of inequalities broadly. And I ended up deciding that I needed to stick with just the gender piece just for precision. There is a whole story to be told here, probably two stories to be told about race. Both of these institutions are grappling with their white past and white present in very, very different, very fascinating ways. And it is really interesting that there are international students, especially at Asbury, but at Southern too, and I think that sort of does provide a sense of some diversity, but it is different than what we would see if we would look at a more diverse institution in another part of the country. So yeah, I mean, maybe that's another project for someone to look at, but I will be very excited to read that one, because I know there's some really interesting stories to be told about race too.
It sounds like a sequel for you. You know, your next project right there. You get a whole series, you know. You know, more stained glass ceilings, right? I don't know, stained glass ceilings too. More stained, more glass, more ceilings. I mean, there's lots of ways you could work with your sequel here.
There's definitely, it's one of those things where you start opening the book and you start realizing how much is inside. So yeah, seminaries. I'm not tired of seminaries yet. So we'll see what happens.
So, you know, what you mentioned the Asbury and their presidents, but you also talk in the book about just the campuses in general, both campuses, but this is Asbury is where it becomes more of a kind of maybe a contradiction or a complexity to the message of these, you know, the buildings are, I mean, these are schools that were built by white men for white men. You know, Asbury has that history of, you know, embedded, even though they've changed in many ways. And the buildings are named for, you know, important white men that have gone before. I mean, everything about the campus is sending a message. And I know, you know, you talked to, you know, I think early in this conversation about you were primarily still focused on the discourse and what people were saying, the rhetoric. But these campuses, as you're walking around and seeing them, they're also sending some messages of who's valued here.
Yeah, definitely. I think that the architecture at both campuses just make these spaces really monuments to the founders, right? Which is the language that Southern uses. But I think would apply to Asbury too. These are, I mean, as institutions are, they are initiated by people who have power and who have financial resources and connections, and those names are embedded, like you said, on the names of buildings, statues. There are a couple of statues at Asbury, both of Charles and John Wesley, the two brothers that the tradition derives its name from. And it's just, it says so much about what goes on beneath the surface when you look at what a community is highlighting and elevating in bronze and stone, right? So yeah, and I think that it's also, I make the point that sometimes these stories say as much in what they don't tell as in what they do tell. And this is not to suggest that there have not been women on these campuses, right, who are very, very influential and integral in what they have become, and even maybe especially at Southern. I mean, you could walk the campus now and see very little attention to women like Diana Garland, who was quite a force for in her work in the social work department. Molly Marshall is another name that's a little bit more well known. I know there's at least one photo of her, but the narrative that is, again, and it's not only told, but it's also sort of embedded in the architecture and in the physical space. The narrative is of her as the villain, not as someone who contributed to the community. So these are intentional choices that are made by these communities of who gets to have their name on the building, right? And often it's a donor, but even that is interesting, right? It says a lot about the economic situations of seminaries, right? They are beholden to the donors in a lot of ways, and that's, I think, an important piece of the puzzle too. But yeah, I think for me, probably this look at material and visual culture around these spaces was probably the most interesting piece of the puzzle, because it's not something that we usually look at and think about when we're looking at ethics like gender ethics. We don't think about, like, well, what Bible verses are you putting on the walls, or who's in the stained glass in the chapel, like, maybe but there's a lot in there, and I think we're even sociologically just now beginning to recognize the power that these physical elements have in how we live our lives and as human actors as we live our lives in these spaces, just walking past these monuments, right? And I don't, you just mean like the statues. I even mean, so at Southern, there's this wall as you walk into this pavilion that has sort of quotes and names etched into it, right? And once you know that, you know, how does it affect us to walk past these memorials to powerful men who said sometimes contradictory things, right, on our way to class or to the coffee shop? So I think there's a lot more in there to be fleshed out, and then this is why I'm just eternally fascinated with culture.
I think Southern Seminary gets a lot of attention on this topic. And, you know, it's the, on one hand, they're leaning well into their theology, and people might say, well, the way you should change is, you know, repent. And we could get into that conversation if you want. But with Asbury, you know, it feels like there's a way or a model here for them, for other seminaries, for churches that really do want to, like, live into this vision of equality for men and women, but haven't maybe unpacked that. Like, what are some ways? And I know I'm gonna move you a little bit away from your sociologist, you know, focus. But what are some ways, prescriptive ways that Asbury or a similar group could take kind of the next step in actually embodying and living out their theology?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's a big question, right? How do we do better?
Maybe that's your next book.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe actually, because I have been giving a lot of thought to this. I mean, I think sociology sometimes is known for, like, laying out all the problems and then saying, well, I don't know, you guys figure it out, right?
You all fix it.
Right. So I think, but I do think I'm slowly landing on some, I don't know if there's solutions, but I think, so one thing that I heard a lot at Asbury is, like, we're trying to hire good women. We're trying our best. We cannot find them. And I think there's that to me is a good way to enter the conversation, because they're recognizing that there is a deficit, and I think recognizing the problem is really an important place to start. And I even like, I mean, the repentance language that you used a minute ago, I think is, I mean, there's no community, there's no tradition that doesn't need to be repenting of something, right? And so if we think that whoever we are, wherever we're coming from, if we think that we're nailing it, probably that's where we need to focus in on, you know, what's falling through the cracks, right? And if we see a problem, like, and one example would be the hiring that Asbury is trying to do, right? This is a problem. It's not working out the way that we think. Maybe we need to ask some more questions here. So I think, I mean, one really basic thing is just to listen, especially on this issue of women's empowerment. I think that when I think of the women that I met with, both faculty and students at Asbury, they had some stories to tell that I think were very, very illuminating. And so I think just sort of, yeah, maybe prioritizing the voices of those who have not been centered in power structures is a good place to start. And I think With the question of hiring, there are so many reasons why places struggle to hire women, right? But I think those can be attended to by looking again at these social and cultural barriers, like the second shift and the fact that women are nurtured differently in churches than men are. But I also think that it's interesting to me. A lot of times I've talked to people who are in this kind of hiring process, and they're like, well, we couldn't find a woman, that's too bad, so we just hired a man. And I haven't seen a lot of thought go into, well, what men are you hiring, right? And I think there's a difference between hiring men who are in line with a theological position and then men who are willing to and interested in kind of unpacking and understanding their own experiences and inquisitive about others. So I think that in the hiring process, it won't solve the problem, right? But it's something that I think could make a big difference. Because when I imagine a community like these seminaries that, you know, maybe they can't make it to the 50% line of women on faculty, but maybe they can fill faculty rosters with both men and women who have their eyes open and who are willing to have hard conversations. So I don't know if that's, yeah, I mean, that's one place to start, but I do think that the repentance piece is also an important factor, because again there's so much, the world has a lot of problems, and I think the more we can name them, then we can kind of go forward in figuring out how to address them.
So my last question for you is, at the beginning of the interview, and you acknowledge this in the book as well, you acknowledge that, you know, you come from a faith tradition different than these two seminaries, but still you're interested, and that's part of why you were studying this. But I wanted to flip that question. Not this is what led you into the study, but what came out of the study for you personally. I wonder, you know, as you're going through this, writing, interviewing all these people, how did this impact your own faith and where you see yourself in the church today?
Ooh, that's a really good question. I think, well, one takeaway is that I have teenagers. I have three teenage boys and then a daughter who's a little bit younger. And just watching the way that the young men in my sample were talking, the ways that they were being formed, made me really want something better for my sons, and which is something that, you know, we were already talking about as a family. But I think this really fueled my fire. Like, we've got to do a better job of talking about and communicating masculinity in a more healthy way. And I think I put in the conclusion, like, this is something that the Christian tradition has plenty of resources for, right? We could be framing masculinity around the humility and nonviolence of Jesus' example, which to me is kind of obvious, right? But we're not, and I say we broadly, like within the kind of the I don't know, the mainstream right now, we see more of this kind of Jesus and John Wayne masculinity. And so I think recognizing how culturally constrained and confined that is really has, I think, deepened my own convictions that Christianity is, you know, not a place for the exercise of power, and it's a place for the marginalized. It is and must be confined by the message and teachings of Jesus. And so I think it's pushing me more in a more countercultural direction, which my tradition already kind of gave me a predisposition to, I guess, already. But I think, yeah, I think at times throughout the project, it is discouraging to see some of this stuff happening and to see so much obscurity where there should be clarity. So I've I work with a lot of students who are on, you know, in full on deconstruction mode, and I can identify with them in ways that I couldn't beforehand. But ultimately, I think this is really, like I said, just really kind of strengthened my resolve to help as much as I can in the spaces that I'm in, to encourage churches and people of Christian faith to think harder, do better, and be more flexible.
Well, excellent. Well, the book is Stained Glass Ceilings, How Evangelicals Do Gender and Practice Power. Lisa, thanks so much for writing this book and for joining us on the program to talk about it. I really enjoyed it, and I hope people will pick it up.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much, Brian. It's been great to talk with you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Dangerous Dogma. You can find more information and links in the show notes at dogma.wordandway.org. And don't forget to check out our website, wordandway.org, to learn more about our other offerings, including A Public Witness, a subscriber e-newsletter to help you make sense of faith, culture, and politics. If you've enjoyed this episode, I hope that you will share it with your friends on Facebook and head over to iTunes or your favorite podcast platform and write a positive review. It really will help more people to find the show. If you'd like to give to support this program, we greatly appreciate it. And all you have to do at wordandway.org is hit the donate button. And whatever you give there will help support the production of this podcast, as well as our website, monthly magazine, and other offerings. If you have any comments or feedback about this program, you can send those to me at bkaylor@wordandway.org. Thanks for listening.